things get a little bit grim.
But this is especially heinous.
Did you tell the police that she was murdered, May?
Nope.
Witchy ghost stuff.
Ah! That made me scared.
A spooky girl amateur hour.
Well, really late for us is not like midnight, so.
Yes, it was. I mean, I was up until like 1.
Oh!
I know.
Yeah, we went to dinner last night for Laura and Kevin's birthday, and my sister is in town from Columbus. Yeah. And she was like, oh my gosh, you want to come back to the house and play dominoes? And at first I was like, absolutely, that sounds like so much fun. Yeah. And then it was like 9:15 and we were still at the restaurant. And I was like,
I'm not playing dominoes.
Oh my gosh. And dominoes is a lot like Monopoly. Like, you're in for the long haul. It's like a 3-hour game.
I love that you guys play dominoes.
Oh, it's so fun.
It's like the cutest old people thing.
Oh, right.
Ever. I mean, we played Rummy.
Yeah.
So I can't say anything, but yes, I love it.
So I was like, at the end of the meal, Kara was like, are you coming to play dominoes? And I was like, baby, I wish I could.
Oh, sweet baby child.
I was like, I am struggling to just keep my eyes open right now.
I got a cat.
Oh, he's a happy kitten.
He's a happy boy. Him hourglass, because no side on floofs. Side on floofed.
Sweet boy.
Sweetie boy. You want to smell the mic?
Put some purrs in there. Sound effects.
Sound effects from Happy the No Tooth Wonder.
Good morning.
Good morning. It is morning. It's early morning here for us.
Yeah, it's not even 10 o'clock yet.
No, it's not.
I got up, like, not super early. I've been getting up at like 6:30 most days. So that I can just like get stuff done before I have to do my real job.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been loving it, like getting up early and like getting stuff done and just feeling like my day, there's more to my day.
Right.
And so this morning I got up at like 7:30, so it was a little bit later, but I still like, I've started a load of laundry. I worked on some other stuff. Mm-hmm. I started cleaning my bathroom. Ryan tried to start a project this morning and it has not gone well.
Uh-oh.
Which is why he's not here.
Where is he at?
Home Depot.
Okay. Things must have really went sideways for him.
We have a leaky faucet, or the sprayer nozzle.
Yeah.
And we went to Home Depot and he was like, let's just get this one. We just need the nozzle. The hose is fine. I was like, okay, whatever you want, babe.
Is it the nozzle? And not like the O-ring?
It's the nozzle.
Okay.
Like, it's rusted and stuff like that. Well, the packaging says like, no tools required. And it's like, we recommend you replace your hose.
Okay.
It doesn't say you have to replace your hose.
Uh-huh.
So it turns out we have to replace the hose.
Yeah.
And so Ryan has to go and like return it and get something else.
Oh, what a bummer. Poor Ryan having a rough morning.
Yeah, he was like, I just thought this was going to be like a take it off and put it back on kind of situation. And now it's like a 2-hour extravaganza.
Nay-nay.
Like, oh, Lord. All right.
Oh, my gosh.
Well,
hi. Happy Lunessa. Happy Lunessa.
Happy Lunessa. We are recording on the 1st? Oh my god.
August 1st.
It's August 1st already.
I love that. You can smell like it's been like chilly.
Uh-huh.
Here it's been like 75 degrees with like a little bit of a nip in the air. And I can feel fall coming. I can feel it in my bones. I feel like my soul is like waking up a little bit.
Yeah. This morning, Ryan and I took Happy out on the deck. He is loving to be outside so we just like went out there with our coffee and like sat on the deck and just chatted this morning while we watched the cat and the lawn, and I was just like, it feels so nice out. It's like a little bit chilly, it wasn't hot. It was so nice.
Should start a cult of people who love fall.
Oh, speaking of cults.
You like it so much?
I liked it a lot.
Thank
good job
you. Thank you so much.
I think there is already a cult of people who like fall. It's called White Girls.
Oh my god. Listen, fall, I hate, you know, gatekeep girl boss, gaslight, whatever that is.
Gatekeep girl boss. Same.
About fall. Fall is for everyone.
Fall is for everyone. Yeah, you're right.
I'm so sorry. I have a donut hair in my eyeball.
Oh gosh, are you sure it's not a happy cat hair?
No, I'm not sure. But there's some variation.
There is cat hair in
there
your eyeball.
There is cat hair in my eyeball, and it's just going to stay there for a while.
I'm so sorry.
Hi, welcome to Cults.
Hi, welcome to Cults, and welcome to A Little Bit Grim.
It's the podcast you're listening to right now. That's Taylor.
That's Jenny over there. You found us.
Thank you for hanging out with us.
We're so happy to have you.
That we are, and boy, do we have like a doozy oozy for you today.
It is going to be a wild ride.
It is going to be a wild ride.
From start to finish. Who's going first today?
Is it me?
We did conspiracies. It is you.
Is it me?
Yep.
Okay.
If you must.
If you insist.
I do.
I am so excited to tell you this really terrible story.
I am really excited as well. Sorry, I just got coffee all over myself.
Calm down, Taylor.
Heck. Okay, go ahead.
You can survive a traumatic event. You can move on and life can be good after a storm, says Sarah McGrath, who is thankful that she's been able to move on with her life after surviving her escape from a cult.
Oh, shit.
McGrath and her, said she and her family joined the commune after her mother, Jennifer Hutchin, a Wichita real estate agent, sold a house in 2001 to Daniel Perez, also known as Lou Castro. Sarah was only 17 years old.
Oh, baby.
When recalling her story to Fox News, she recalled that her mom had a journal and had written how she felt she needed to protect Lou or Daniel. She supposed that he seemed innocent or someone who cared too much. Jennifer was really thoughtful when it came to people, so she felt like she somehow needed to protect Lou. He was very charismatic and quite the talker, and he somehow appeared wise. So, Jennifer moved Sarah and Emily, who was 11, her youngest daughter, to Angel's Landing. Sarah didn't like Perez at all, but her mom felt a bond with him and was convinced he was an angel who could tell you when you were going to die.
Oh, red flag number one.
Red flag number one. Keep the tally up, because there's a couple things.
Okay, great.
In the beginning, things seemed well, as they always do. The community was close-knit and supportive of each other. And when Sarah was asked when things no longer seemed to be okay within the group, she stated that things drastically changed the first time Perez raped her.
Oh, okay.
Number two.
Yeah. All right.
Danielle Perez, Danielle, Daniel,
Danielle.
I just pronounce it phonetically, like how I spelled it. Danielle Perez had gotten away with pedophilia, rape, assault, murder, and insurance fraud.
Fuck, dude.
For at least 15 years before his arrest in 2010 at the Angels Landing commune.
Oh my gosh, that's recent.
It's very recent. A small ranch just outside Wichita, Kansas. Before settling, he traveled state to state with a small band of dedicated followers. Unlike other cult leaders we've talked about, he didn't write a book or release a manifesto or monthly indoctrination newsletters. He didn't really profess any end time prophecies. He didn't recruit from broken and vulnerable people like these. They just like came to him in their regular interactions. Like, she would have never joined the cult if she wasn't his real estate agent.
Right. Okay.
Organically procured followers.
Yeah.
He didn't claim to be a prophet, a god, or a shepherd. He was a wackadoodle who, through charisma and charm, convinced many humans to follow him unwaveringly. These followers were people who maybe were easily swayed by charm, perhaps to open up a mind towards metaphysical possibilities of the universe. He didn't have much more theological notion for his followers other than, like, I can probably try to get you into heaven, or maybe you will just be reincarnated after you die. IDK.
Huh.
So,
okay.
Much of his life prior to the commune is a mystery, and he currently lives out the rest of his days on a cot in El Dorado prison in Butler County, and he refuses to acknowledge the things that occurred or confirm details about the commune or his actions from ex-members, and chooses to not engage in any outreach from the media.
Weird.
Mm-hmm. Now, he did some gross cult things, but unlike cult things that we've seen in the past, although his followers, and it's not clear whether he claimed this or if it was like the general group consensus,
okay,
that he was an angel who was thousands of years old.
Uh-huh.
But okay. He has not ever been heard saying these things about himself, either in writing or...
Okay, so it's not like Jonestown where he was like,
I am the new god.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Correct. Right. He first attracted law enforcement's attention in 2003 when he was living with a small group of people from mixed backgrounds on a 20-acre property called Angel's Landing. First, there were the fancy cars. Most of the vehicles on the property were worth more than $40,000.
That's quite pricey for a car.
Uh-huh. According to the Wichita Eagle, that's like a very baseline BMW.
Yeah.
There was a swimming pool and multiple houses on the property as well.
Mm, fun.
He did not appear to work, and local law enforcement couldn't find a paper trail on a man calling himself Lou Castro. Now, allow me to introduce Patricia Hughes. She and her husband, Brian, were also communal members, and she was like a second mother to Sarah and Emily.
Mm-hmm.
In June 2003, Sarah was on her way to a car dealership where Perez was supposed to meet her when her little sister called. Patricia Hughes, who was like a second mother to the girls, had slipped and fallen into the pool and she was dead. Sedgwick County Sheriff's Office Detective Ron Goodwin had his eye on Perez already. When he heard of 26-year-old Hughes' death, he took an active interest in finding out just exactly what was happening down there at the dang old Heckin Ranch.
So many red flags.
I know. He's just like, his ears are perked up. He's like
his little antennas are like, whoop,
whoop, whoop, whoop, whoop, whoop. Something's amiss here. After Patricia's death, her husband, Brian, became severely depressed, of course, yeah, as you do, and began talking with Perez more, having a lot of one-on-one time with him, seeking guidance and solace and counsel.
Oh,
uh-huh.
No.
Perez comforted him by saying, "One day you'll get your chance to go to the other side," which... gives me like Teal Swan vibes.
Oh, yeah.
A little bit. Did I tell you that I got dragged on TikTok?
No.
The other day, a video, this girl popped up and she was like playing a Teal Swan video. And she was like, "This woman has absolutely changed my life. You need to stop what you're doing and like go listen to her."
No.
"If you're going through a rough time," and da 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 da. And so I commented it. Uh-huh. And I was like, "Be careful. Teal Swan is dangerous." And you would have thought... that I said I run around and kick puppies on the weekend. I mean, people came for my throat.
Oh my god.
It was so funny.
That's terrifying.
I mean, it was weird. There were like K-pop fans for it was so bizarre. Anyway. I just got so sidetracked. Oh, because that reminded me of Teal Swan. Yeah. It's the encouraging idea of, like, hey, life is short and your paradise awaits you or your reincarnation. And, like, your suffering will be your reward. Mm-hmm. I just, like, found that counsel to be very upsetting.
Yeah.
Anyway, when Brian died in a freak accident at an auto body shop where he worked in 2006, the good detective Goodwin dove into every single little bit of personal and financial information he could. On every single soul living at Angel's Landing.
Ooh.
He was like, no, this
too many freak accidents.
This cannot be.
Nope.
Goodwin found a disturbing pattern of expensive life insurance policies being taken out on people in Perez's circle.
Uh-oh.
Then cashed in by the members.
Red flag. Number 3 or 4.
Or 5. We don't even know how many red flags at this point. About every 2.5 years, bank account balances would get low in the family, and then someone would die.
Oh my gosh, what a pattern.
Yeah.
What a pattern.
What followed was a years-long investigation, which was difficult because Goodwin did not have police reports, victims, or know Perez's true identity.
Oh, okay.
He once tailed him to a restaurant and tried unsuccessfully several times to get his prints, but he proved elusive. Meanwhile, Perez was regularly raping Sarah for years under the guise of fixing her.
Oh, ew.
Mm-hmm. She said, "There was nothing I could do." I remember saying, "Am I fixed now?"
Oh, poor sweet honey.
Over 7 years, he sexually abused her.
That's so sad.
It is so sad. In 2008, Sarah's mother died in a freak car accident. Sarah found solace in the arms of the man who had become her husband, Daniel McGrath. Goodwin intensified his investigation, afraid that after another 2 years, there's going to be another death, because that is the pattern. And when McGrath realized some of what was going on in his girlfriend's makeshift family, he sent an email to the FBI through their website in 2010.
Yes.
Goodwin began working with federal agents and found the identity Perez was likely about to inhabit next in Tennessee. In April 21st, 2010, authorities arrested Perez at his new home in Tennessee.
So he just, like, peaced out and, like, moved to Tennessee.
Skipped town and assumed a new identity because he's killing off his cult member, so he can just...
It's not very sustainable.
No, it's not very sustainable. But he doesn't... He's not, like, a planner the way a lot of these other cult leaders are.
Right, he's not looking for a big following. He's just looking for people he can kill off.
Yes, he's looking for a prey pool.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Icky.
Super gross. Through interviews with Sarah, her younger sister, and other members of the commune, they uncovered Perez's shocking methods of manipulation and abuse, and he was charged with 28 felonies.
Holy crap.
In February 2015, he was convicted on all counts and sentenced to 80 years in prison.
Okay.
Goodwin called it the most bizarre story he'd ever heard, but said Perez's conviction was probably the most amazing feeling in my law enforcement career.
Wow.
For more shocking Angel's Landing story, a lot of this information you can watch on Deadly Cults.
Okay.
And it has all of her interviews and a first person. You can't tell the story better than the...
The original.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. So, or better than the victim.
Yeah.
So go check it out.
Wow.
It is.
Where can they, we find?
It's on Oxygen.
Oxygen. Okay. Mm-hmm. Cool.
You can you can Google it. Like, it's on YouTube.
Okay. Wow.
You can find it. It is so, I feel like very rarely a lot of these like cults swindle their money in like various methods, but I don't think I've ever heard of another cult that did like life insurance fraud.
Right, that's pretty rare.
It's so weird.
Because it's so important for them to have a following normally. Yeah. And you can't really have that if you keep killing them off.
It's like drug dealers who deal fentanyl.
Yeah. Killing off your people.
Your customer base. It's just bad marketing.
Not a good plan.
No. Let alone is it morally ambiguous.
Right.
But like.
Oh my gosh. All right, well,
Taylor, tell me a tale.
Okay, I have quite the tale for you.
Oh, I can't wait.
Which is actually kind of parallel to yours.
Oh, really? Insurance fraud?
There is some fraud and money.
Interesting.
Kind of swindling, money issues. So, and also similar in the fact that, like, his followers end up being kind of organic.
Oh, okay.
And he doesn't go out and recruit.
He doesn't go out and Jehovah's Witness them.
Right. So, the last couple of cults that I've done have been kind of heavy. And this guy, there's no death in mine.
Oh, good.
Which we love a moment of...
Lighthearted.
Lighthearted. There still are victims. There are people who got really... Just the short end of the stick. Okay. In here, and they lost a lot. They did not lose their lives.
Okay.
So, sometimes it's easy to understand how quickly people can get wrapped up in a cult. Even the smartest, most able-minded people get caught up in cults. It's cult like the one that I'm going to tell you about today that really leave me scratching my head and thinking, but how? I'm going to tell you the story of a charming and charismatic, if not delusional, man named Scott Caruthers and his Beta Dominion xenophilia cult.
Oh, wow. Xenophilia.
Yeah. I'll get into, like, the definition of what this means here in a little bit, but we don't really get into the part where he has a, what the media starts calling a cult, until about midway through. So, but okay. I have a lot of setup to tell you about.
Okay. I'm just going to lay back.
All right. Move your mic so that I can hear your reactions,
okay.
Though.
Okay. Hold on.
Otherwise, it
I just screamed directly into the microphone. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
I apologize to future Taylor in editing. Who's going to get a jump scare?
Yeah, that's true. All right. I think that'll be all right.
Perfect.
Great. Okay. Oh my gosh. Scott Caruthers. It was actually born Arthur Brooke Crothers.
That's like a much cooler name.
Arthur Brooke.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. So he's changes the spelling of his last name. So Crothers is C-R-O-T-H-E-R-S, where Caruthers is C-A-R-U-T-H-E-R-S.
That's dumb.
Just dumb. There's a lot of things in here that I'm like, but why?
Just on a whim.
Yeah. So he was born in 1945 and grew up in Anne Arundel, which is a Disney palace. County in rural Arundel.
It's from Lord of the Rings, isn't it?
It's also from Frozen.
Oh, yeah. Arundel. Yeah.
Yeah.
What? Is that a real place?
Anne Arundel County. Yeah.
Okay.
In Tick Neck Road near Pasadena.
What?
Tick Neck Road.
Who? What crackhead named this place?
I don't know. Some crazy person. He was the youngest of three boys who were all packed into one bedroom growing up. Can you imagine the smell?
No.
Ew.
And I would not like to try to.
Yuck. We know that his father's name was John, but we only know his mother's name by Doll because that is what his father called her.
Aw.
His brothers were John and Joe. Doll had a love for cats, but not like in like a healthy, cute way.
Oh.
She had an actual shit ton of cats in that small home, something getting into the upper teen numbers, like 17, 18 cats.
Ooh, that's a lot of cats.
A lot of cats. And their house always smelled like cat urine.
No shit.
Yeah. Joe Crothers said that their dad was the source of a lot of issues in the house, and the boys did their best to just stay out of his way. John Jr. said that Scott, which is what I'm going to call him from now on, just because that's what he starts going by, okay. And that's what, like, all of the... any media you see about this is going to call him Scott. So okay. That's what we're going with.
You got it.
He tested at 138 IQ, which 140 is genius.
He's a smart cookie.
So he's pretty smart and into everything. He was a real go-getter. So John Jr. was just like, he had a lot going for him.
Just a busy bee.
Yeah. When Scott was 12, the family moved to Maryland. By the time he was a teen, his brothers had both joined the Air Force. And when Scott was able, he did the same. He dropped out of high school in 10th grade and at 17 joined the Army. And at this time, it would have been about 1962.
Okay.
Right off the bat here, we start seeing some big old red flags in cult land.
Okay.
Scott was discharged from the Army within his first month.
Oh.
He didn't even finish basic training.
Oh.
Scott says that he was discharged because he was so smart that they wanted to give him an opportunity to do something better or something other than serve in the Army. He said that the Army gave him a special battery of tests before offering him a discharge, pending special circumstances. Basically, they wanted him to do secret missions with the CIA.
Is that true?
This is what Scott says.
Oh, so no.
So no.
Okay.
We're going to go with no.
All right.
The Army won't release the details of the discharge, but Scott's first wife says that she did see the paperwork and it said unfit for military duty.
Ooh.
So we don't have a paper trail. But we do have an opposing viewpoint.
Okay.
But we got to talk about how he met his first wife. So in the 60s, you didn't have to be actually going to high school in order to go to prom.
What?
So if somebody's parents could, like, confirm this for us, that would be really excellent. But apparently you could just, like, go to prom.
No way.
I don't know.
God. But, no wonder so many people were serial killers in the 60s.
Right. You could just go to prom and have like a smorgasbord of teenage girls.
What a lawless land.
Right.
Okay. I gotta know more.
Yeah. All right. Girls often went, even if they were single, because there was a chance they'd meet their knight in shining armor at prom and they'd become kept women and lived happily ever after.
Are you joking me?
No.
Aspire to more.
Right. So at this point, like, women were going to college, but that wasn't necessarily widespread normality.
Uh-huh.
So this was a really good opportunity to go and go to a dance and meet boys who maybe were...
suitable.
Suitable, and you could get married.
Gross.
So Scott and his first wife met at this Seton High prom, and he swept Kathleen Wimbley off right off her feet. He was so charming and convincing, Kathleen said. He said that he was from another planet. He was very, very convincing, at least to a 16-year-old, that he had his spaceship parked on the hill in Cattonville somewhere.
What?
He picked up a glassy rock with gold on it, and he said that it was something left behind by the creature that was chasing him.
She believed it?
Yeah, she believed it. 100%. Was like, spaceship man.
Tell me more.
Take me with you.
Hold my hand.
To your other planet.
Whisper sweet nothings into my ear.
Yep.
I don't like it.
So Kathleen was 16 and Scott would have been 17 or 18 at this point. They were married a year later in 1963. Only 8 months later, Kathleen gave birth to their first daughter, a girl they named Fawn. Sadly, she died when she was an infant.
That is so sad.
Yes.
Cute name, though.
Really. To save money, Kathleen and Scott moved in with his parents, but when his father died in a heart attack of 1966, the house fell into shambles. Mm-hmm. The house reeked of urine, Kathleen said. The cats were pretty much allowed to run free. The furniture was torn and dirty. This is really gross.
Okay.
His mother collected her husband's fingernail clippings and kept them in a jar. And she just loved to show them off, Kathleen said. So, I mean, obviously, there were really big issues in this household. Like, even this is, I think, the tip of the iceberg, but really this is all we really know about his childhood.
Okay.
So just, you know, knowing what we know about, like, mental health, I think that there were a lot of mental health issues here.
Yeah.
That probably had something to do with everything that follows.
Okay.
Kathleen and Scott's marriage was definitely in trouble. One evening, Scott rented a limo and a tux and hit up another prom. Yep. There he met a 17-year-old girl named Una. He wooed her and told her that his first wife was dead. And Kathleen divorced Scott about a year and a half later, but Scott had already remarried Una.
Are you joking?
No. So he was married to two women at one time.
Ew.
Una thought Kathleen was dead, and Kathleen was like, why the fuck are you running around on me?
Ew.
This is just the beginning. So, okay. 3 years later, Una found Scott in a parked car with yet another prom date, a girl named Billy Gardner. She was 16. Billy waited until her 18th birthday before eloping with Scott, who was 27 at this point.
That's so gross.
Yep. Billy divorced him 2 years later. By that time, he had had a son with Una. 6 years later, she divorced him. By then, he was 35 and living for 5 years with another woman named Rochelle Kern, who was 21.
What?
Literally, they were all overlapping with one another, and they all lived in the same town. He was definitely married to multiple women at once, but because this was before we had digital records, it was really easy for him to get away with it because they would just get married in different counties.
I'm so sorry. How many people are in this town? Where is this?
Maryland.
There can't be that many people in
Maryland. It's really probably not a very big town. But...
And, like, parents are still allowing their daughters to marry these men when you're 16.
Yeah.
So that's still a thing.
My mom got married when she was 16.
That's insanity.
Yep. She got married while she was in high school, and her mom had to sign off on it, but that was Virginia, so...
Oh.
Yeah, and it would have been 70s.
Wow.
Late 70s. Okay, so now we've got Scott, who is 35, and he's living with Rochelle, who is 21. And he's got a habit of changing jobs as quickly as he changes women. He was a salesman, florist, milkman, truck driver, and security guard, and he always seemed to live beyond his means. Una said he was the kind of person that when he had $100, he would spend $150, and he was bouncing checks all over the place.
Oh my God.
In addition to that, the wives were being told that he was away so much because he had all these top secret missions to do for the CIA, so that's why they never really questioned, like, where he was.
Oh my God.
Yeah. They said that he wore an Air Force uniform and often traveled to Florida, and he would tell Una that he was going to flight school and Billy that he was quitting his job as a government assassin to become a pilot for the Blue Angels.
What?
Yeah. He rigged a car with extra antennas so people would think that he was an undercover cop. He was super all the top all the time and just loved to put on a show. At some point along this journey, he started calling himself Scott to rid himself of his birth name, Arthur. It is worth noting that Scott was really into working out and was always at the gym, so he was considered pretty good looking at the time, which explains why so many women were bamboozled by this man.
Ugh.
Not my type for sure, but he's not completely unfortunate looking.
Okay. He's unfortunate looking.
1983, Rochelle and Scott had a son. So this is child number three.
Oh my gosh.
In 1984, Rochelle found out that Scott was at it again, and this time with 23-year-old named Paula. Paula and Scott eloped in June of that year, and their son was born a month later. So we're on number four.
Stop breeding.
Can't. Cannot, will not.
Ugh. It makes me so sickened.
Paula complained that he was absent a lot, but he said that he was busy doing all these heckin' missions.
I'm very... You don't understand what's going on in my the Galactic Federation.
My schedule. You... is busy. My planner is packed.
Oh my god.
But in reality, he was living a whole secret life with yet another woman named Randy, who was a 24-year-old teacher.
What?
So you think we're at number five or six of the wives.
What? He's gotta be running out of counties.
Gotta be. Well, at this point, he's been divorced like three times. So he could get remarried in those counties because he's got a divorce record.
Love of Peter and Paul.
Absolutely. In 1985, Scott went to a party and met a couple named Ermina and Robert. Ermina and Robert had been married for 3 years and they were both 25. Robert said he was passing himself off to be in the Air Force, even as far as to say that he was an astronaut. He seemed like a decent guy, very friendly. Robert assumed that all was well because Scott had a girlfriend, but things quickly became shady.
Yeah.
Robert noticed Scott flirting with Ermina often, but he garnered sympathy from them as well. One evening, he showed up at their doorstep in tears.
Oh.
Scott said that he had been doing test missions that day for the Air Force, and he accidentally shot down one of his partners. Robert said, I can still see him, sitting there at the kitchen table talking about it, dropping his head and his eyes filling up with tears, saying, the missiles weren't supposed to fire, but they did. They lived with Robert's parents, and his mother, Virginia, called bullshit. Even Ermina's sister was like, yeah, right. Like, astronauts do not live in Glen Burnie, which is like the town they were in. But Ermina believed every word.
Oh, my God.
One night, the three of them were at a party when Scott put on some music, dimmed the lights, and made fuck me eyes to Ermina.
Ew, Taylor.
I know.
Edit that out. That was so gross of you to say.
He did.
It made fuck me. Ugh.
He did. So Ermina said... Oh, Robert was like, no, 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 I do not think so. And was like, let's go, Ermina. Like, this is getting weird. And Ermina was like, no, thank you. I'll stay. You can go, though.
Oh, Ermina.
I know.
Oh, my God.
She also said, I'm not strong enough to tell you what's happening right now, but I will. Soon after, Virginia, Robert's mom, recalled, she went off to exercise one morning and she never came back. All she took was her pillow and her cat.
To exercise?
Yep.
That wasn't a red flag for anyone?
Yep, nope. But
she took Fluffy and her pillow and is going to go do cardio.
Go to the gym.
Can you imagine trying to do cardio with a cat?
Oh, gosh.
Ugh.
Cardio is running after a cat.
No shit.
By 1986, Ermina had changed her name to Dashiell Lashara. Scott either convinced her or told her to tell people that she worked for the government as well. Now, at this point, Scott is living with both Dashiell and Randy. So they live all together as like a trio.
Okay.
Around this time, Scott had an idea for an invention.
Oh.
It was a dumbbell that you could lift without gripping. He said that he came up with the idea in 1984 after he injured his hand during a mountain climbing accident. An accident I am very convinced that never actually happened.
Did not happen.
He called the idea Strong Put, but he needed money to make and market it.
Mm-hmm.
Soon, the charming, slimy, smooth-talking man emerged again to woo investors.
Ugh.
Richard Gershberg was a young lawyer in June of 1985 when a client came to him to ask him to check the paperwork on Strong Put. Richard basically said that the paperwork was shoddy at best, and eventually Scott found out his paperwork wasn't up to snuff, so he asked Richard to help redo all the paperwork so it sounded more valid.
Okay.
Richard was intrigued by Scott and talked to his law partner, David Pearl, about Scott and his invention. And then they both decided to invest in Strong Put. They also said that Scott was brilliant. David Pearl even said, he's probably the smartest person I've ever met. Richard and David were both in their early 30s at this point with young families. They were well known in their communities and well respected. So when they talked to their friends and family about this invention and Scott Carruthers, more investors came forward to back the product.
Can we? I'm so sorry.
You're fine.
I need a pause.
Yeah.
A dumbbell that doesn't have to be lifted.
It's like a circle. Like, think Pac-Man. Okay. So it's got like a cutout in it in a circle, and you just like lift your hand in it. And you can lift it with your arm instead of, like curling your hands around it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So you lift it.
Okay. I thought it was levitating gym equipment.
No.
Okay.
Nothing quite that exciting.
Okay.
Yeah.
We love an invention for the differently abled.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Okay.
So businessman David Squire poured nearly $200,000 into StrongPut, which incorporated in 1987 with Scott as the chairman, Randy as the president, and Dashiell as the executive director.
Wow.
The three principals all had leading roles in DAR products, the company set up to hold StrongPut's patents. David Squire said, "I believed in him, in his ability to make things happen, partly because of the way he presented himself and the way he talked about his connections." Things get even weirder in their private lives, when Scott starts telling people that he met Dashiell when she was an orphan girl in Germany.
What?
Yeah. He was telling people that he adopted her and he brought her to the States. And when she finally like came of age, they fell in love. He would even.
This is the exact plot of Lolita.
Yeah. 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 He's insane. He would even tell the story with her sitting right there, and she would just nod along in agreement. So we don't know if he brainwashed her into actually believing that this is how things happened, or if she just, like, went with this lie that he was saying.
I am not obedient enough for this. I'd be like, why? No.
Why did you say that?
No, you didn't.
Weirdo. Don't tell people that.
Right. You're lying. He's lying, everyone. He's lying.
Just FYI. Lies. Despite this, the popularity of the idea of StrongPut continued to grow, and investors had pitched in about $1 million at this point.
Jeez Louise.
I know. In 1991, Richard Matz joined the ranks and replaced Randy as president. He started finding really strange things, like some of the investment checks had been made out to Randy rather than the company. There was no business plan, no investors list, no stock certificates, basically no paper trail at all. And Richard Matz said, "I spent a month trying to get a list of what they spend money on." He also said that Scott and Randy traveled at company expense, but that he never saw the bills, so never saw anything expensed. Richard Matz then wrote a business plan, but he said that Scott altered it to make everything look way better than it was.
Okay.
Still
cooking the books.
Yep. Still somehow StrongPut launched in 1992 at a huge trade show in Atlanta. There, Scott rounded up some more folks for his inner circle.
Oh.
One was a man named Scott Reines, who originally printed t-shirts for StrongPut, but later became a live-in bodyguard.
Well, that is quite a turn in career path.
Yeah. A little different.
Yeah.
StrongPut ended up being a huge hit and was the star of the trade show. It was featured in GQ magazine, New York Times, CBS This Morning. People were freaking out about this new contraption that would surely be in gyms everywhere. And I listened to a podcast on this, and they made a really good point. So, like, at this point, it's the early 90s, which is when, like, Bowflex was big.
Yeah.
VHSs with workouts at home, like, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It started getting really big at this point. So, meanwhile, Scott, Randy, and Dashiell are all still living this lie of being secret CIA agents. And they had some folks over one evening for dinner and quickly shuffled folders out of the way. And these people said that they, like, had files on their desk and they kept, like, shuffling them away. And they would say that they were secret CIA files.
What?
The couple...
What?
I know. The couple they had over was Bonnell and Camille Easley. And they said that during dinner, Scott casually said, "You know, Dashiell and I are actually not from this planet. In fact, we have our own language." And then they started talking to each other in code.
What?
It's like a clitter clattering back and forth in, like, crazy Morse code. Lots of clicks. I don't know. Then they said that their cats connected them to the mothership.
Oh my God. Throwback.
Cats are aliens. Scott said that the mothership would rescue them from the quote-unquote earth changes that he, and that he, like Jesus, would come from the clouds. I'm telling you.
Just me and Jesus.
Me and Jesus coming from the clouds. Scott then let them in on Strong Put's role in all of this. It was a product that was, quote, a commercial design for a futuristic device called the inertialess lever, which would be used by NASA.
Okay.
I have no idea what any of that means. But he's basically telling people that this device is connected to something that is going to, like, save Earth from the Earth changes.
Okay.
Anyhow. You'd think that the Easleys would have been like, okay, let's pull out of this crazy man's invention.
No, do they eat this shit up?
But because they'd already invested so much money, they decided to stick it out.
Mm.
All right, so we're going to go back to the lawyers that I mentioned earlier, Richard and David.
Okay.
So they were both still super loyal to Scott by this time. David even wrote in the newsletter that our fearless inventor had constantly challenged me to spread my wings to see a larger landscape. Like a commander on the Starship Enterprise, when faced with too many overwhelming circumstances, he would repeat the challenge. Make it so, he said in so many words. David, you will soar to a whole new understanding of purpose.
What?
Uh-oh.
Make it so.
Make it so.
Oh my gosh.
Now, people started to see a pattern that Scott was becoming very preachy and that people around him started looking at Scott like a hero and worshiping the ground he walked on. David Squire noticed this and said, you know, he could be a cult leader.
Oh, funny you should mention that.
Right. So far, I've mentioned a lot of men who got tied up in the Strong Put invention, but it really was like a community. So they all went to dinner parties together and talked a lot. The wives all started being brought around, and the wives all became friends.
Okay.
So for every man I mentioned, double it, because that person's got a partner.
Okay.
And then all of those people have children.
Oh, Jesus.
So while we've got like five men in this, we've got five women, and then probably one or two kids each. So, we know how Scott is with women.
Smooth talker.
Uh-huh. Deals were being struck to get Strong Put on TV shows and in movies, but these deals kept falling through, and people started losing money.
Uh-oh.
But if anyone started asking too many questions or thinking about quitting or pulling out, Scott would just say, you know, the black van can show up at any time.
What a vague, weird threat.
Right. One arrangement after another fell through until 1996, when Scott and a few of his cronies formed a new publicly traded company, Carnegie International Corp. Within a few years, it would have 12,000 shareholders and be listed on the American Stock Exchange. There are a few stock things that happened that I don't understand and I'm not going to get into. But basically, Scott and a handful of other people got about $3 million worth of stocks, and they pulled all their money out, and then Strong Put and this company all folded within days of everyone getting their money out.
Okay.
So all the other investors were shit out of luck. The Easleys lost their home in the fallout. Other investors refinanced loans and took their children out of college because nobody could pay for anything.
Jesus.
Yeah. But Scott had $3 million because he pulled all his money out.
Oh.
So now with all of this money, Scott's life was made. He wasn't the guy with $100 making it $150 anymore, which meant he could spend his time focusing on all the people he managed to draw around him in the last few years. By 1997, friends and family members of Scott's, friends and family members of the people in Scott's inner circle started to worry. Scott and Dashiell moved into an isolated home on the aptly named Scott Drive.
Ha!
Somewhere along the way, Randy had had enough and moved to North Carolina, so she peaced out.
Okay.
She ended up marrying the president of the Bank of America.
Wow!
Yeah.
That would have trade-in.
Yeah. And she does not talk about Scott.
No shit.
The number of people in the inner circle started moving closer to Scott and Dashiell. Most families were relocated to be near him. And by whole families, I mean the wives and the daughters, too. Just a small spoiler, but I know everyone's ears just perked up. There isn't any proof or accusations of Scott abusing the children, but at the very least, they were definitely being groomed.
Okay.
The people around him all believed that he was from a different planet.
Wow.
When someone new starts coming around and asking questions, if they get close enough to saying something like, wow, these people are weird, it's like they're from another planet, everyone would get super serious and be like, I'd wondered when you put it together. This is very serious. I'll have to make some calls.
Sorry.
Finally.
It's so stupid.
But can you imagine, like, I'm imagining, like, the kind of the upper echelon of society.
Yeah. Business people.
Business people with throwing these lavish parties. I'm thinking, like, the OC.
Right. The Hills.
Yeah. And everybody's like, oh, by the way, our leader is from a different planet.
Fuck me.
Finally, this is when Scott starts referring to his group as Beta Dominion Xenophilia, which means literally nothing when you break it down. Beta is the second. Dominion means control or ownership. And Xenophilia means love of another culture. Doesn't mean anything. But if you ask Scott or the group members, it meant next world alien lovers.
Oh my God.
Ew. Next world alien lovers.
All right.
They said that BDX had an intelligence level that was 39 places above the intelligent level of the White House. So what the White House knows, we're 39 places above that.
No, we're not.
No.
No, we're not. No, we're not.
Especially some guy named Scott.
No offense to all the Scots out there. No. Listen, I think Scots are just like a good old simple boy.
I do too.
That's how I feel about Scots. I feel like they're generally good natured.
Absolutely. They wear a lot of flannel.
Yes, they do. They know how to work on cars. Like, they can change your oil.
Yeah. Uncle Scott. I always think of an Uncle Scott.
Yeah. I have an Uncle Scott.
You do have an Uncle Scott. That's basically what I think.
Who also will change my oil.
Yeah. If I need him. He's in flannel.
In flannel. He's a great guy.
All right. So, Scott claimed that the alien that controlled him was the commander of, quote unquote, the League. Scott was the commander on Earth, and Dashiell was his queen. Dashiell flies the colors of the organization openly, as BDX-1 was the tag on her Lexus.
What were the colors?
Oh, I have no idea.
Okay. I would like to see what the flag is.
I know. I would love to see the crest, please.
Yes.
Everyone in the group was told to start writing down their daily thoughts in a journal that they would then fax to Dashiell for her review.
That's so a dated sentence.
Yeah. This is like the second time somebody has faxed something in a story that I've told.
Fax me your deets.
Yeah. This was a part of their training in addition to eating well and exercising often. Overall, people were getting stronger and losing weight, so the benefits seemed to outweigh some of the more odd things that were happening to them. They were like, I feel great.
Okay.
They were told that if they followed the training, they would be saved from the upcoming Earth changes.
Oh.
In addition to these lifestyle changes, Scott insisted that everyone have cats in their home. Lewis Dardick wasn't thrilled when his wife brought home a few at Scott's suggestion. Because he was deathly allergic to cats.
Oh! That poses a problem.
Yeah. But his wife was like, Scott told me to.
Sorry.
It's your problem if you're allergic.
Guess you're not getting into space, bud.
Right. Friends and family of members of BDX were definitely starting to notice changes, both physical and mental. One of the couples had a bar mitzvah for their son in 1997, and this was the last event that was pretty open to outsiders. People were unnerved that the guests of honor seemed to be Scott and Dashiell instead of the kid.
Oh, that's weird.
The next year, when the same couple had a bar mitzvah for their daughter, instead, they threw a celestial event and had X-Files playing on videotape in the background.
What?
Yep. Sorry, babe, you don't get a bar mitzvah.
You get a celestial event.
Yes. Which, like, I would love to go.
I would like to trade in my wedding, please.
I would like a celestial
event. I would like a celestial event. Thank you. Yes, thanks.
In the center of the group, there are about 10 to 12 adults deeply involved with BDX. Most of these people are couples with children, and Scott would eventually pull the you're not married anymore card that did not go over well with most of the men.
Oh.
Tim Hackerman left the group, and his wife, Deborah Hackerman, who had since changed her name to Dulce Nedek. Nedek.
Dulce?
Dulce. D-U-L-S-A.
Interesting.
Yeah. And their daughter, when he realized that things were starting to get out of control. When he came up to pick his daughter for their weekly visit, he immediately filed for emergency custody. Louis Dardick, who was not related to Dulcinea Dick, he quickly followed suit and filed for emergency custody of his three children.
Smart man.
Yep. The judge granted custody in both of the cases. This made Tim and Louis enemies of BDX. Enemies were referred to RAD. And they would receive threats from the people still deep in the BDX circle. Tim's ex-wife, Deborah Naldulsa, told him, "One call and you'll be gone."
Ah!
Yeah. Tim Hackerman, Louis Dardick, and Martin Tolkoff, the uncle of Elaine Gershberg, who was one of the women in the group, hired a private detective. When Michael Tolkoff, Martin's son, working actively behind the scenes. So there's like a small group of people who are like, something weird is happening. We got to get these people out.
Yeah.
The PI discovered a fax cartridge in the trash of Scott's home.
I can't with this.
I know. With hundreds of journal entries that the group had been sending.
Oh, I love that.
Yep. This was the tip of the iceberg and the catalyst for a full-blown investigation.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Yep. The group explained away the journal entries, which included graphic recounts of the women's sexual encounters with Scott, as merely science fiction writing, and they were only giving Scott inspo for his upcoming science fiction novel.
Really?
Yep. The American Stock Exchange found irregularities at this time as well and ordered all trading of the stocks associated to Scott Carruthers to halt. The stocks basically became worthless.
Ooh.
Scott & Co. hired a bodyguard named Amir Tabassi. Tabassi was one of the only outsiders brought into the group. He wasn't a friend of a friend or anything like that. They just hired him.
Okay.
From what I could find, he wasn't related to anyone in the group intimately before he was hired on. Scott was getting increasingly aggravated by the perceived enemies of the group and thought, you know, I bet I could just off them.
Oh!
Yeah. He went ahead and talked to Tabassi and said that he would pay him to kill Louis Dardick, Tim Hackerman, Michael Tolkoff, and David Gable. The idea was to kill them before the looming court date to sort out some of the business fraud. Tabassi said that he was given a diamond tennis bracelet as a down payment, which was worth $6,600. And I found a couple of different numbers for the full promised amount, which ranges, and this is quite a range, anywhere from $100,000 to $200 million.
What?
Right.
Golly.
But poor Amir Tabassi was like, that's not bodyguard shit, and immediately went to the police.
Mm-hmm.
The state police and the FBI converged on Scott's home.
That's not bodyguard shit.
Nope.
This is outside of my job description.
Absolutely. So the state police and the FBI converged on Scott's home around 2 a.m. on Wednesday, September 26th, 2001. They took him, Dashiell Dulsa, and David Pearl into custody with a $1 million bond each.
Ooh.
About a month later, about a month later, Amy Dardick was also arrested in the murder for hire plot, but was released on a lower bail and went to seek a deprogramming treatment.
Yeah.
The trial didn't start for a year after the arrests were made. The defendants were all found sane and able to stand trial. They were charged with conspiracy and solicitation of murder.
Mm.
Dashiell Lashara was sentenced to time served for her conviction and was placed on 5 years probation. She left the Carroll County Detention Center the day after she was sentenced.
Wow.
Dulsa Nedek also entered a guilty plea. Under the plea agreement, Nedek would serve 18 months of a 15-year prison term. She served her time by the time she was sentenced and released.
Okay.
David Pearl entered an Alford plea, which basically means he knows that there's enough evidence to convict him, but he didn't plead guilty.
Ew, what? Yeah.
To one charge of conspiracy to commit murder. He was found not criminally responsible and released from jail in February 2003 with orders to pursue mental health treatment. Scott Carruthers was found guilty and was sentenced to a suspended 40-year sentence plus probation. He was released and is a free heckin' man to this day. He is 76 years old.
What?
Yep, he's just out and about.
What?
Yeah.
I not to be problematic, but a lot of this smells like schizophrenia.
Yeah.
I mean, very well organized.
Yeah. An organized.
Yeah. Or some kind of delusion disorder is happening with that man.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it has to go back to his childhood. And, like, there were a lot of problems in that house, I think, that we don't know about.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that lent to this delusion. But you can buy strong put. Like, you can buy the weights online.
Oh, yeah?
They're available on eBay.
Does he profit?
I don't know, because they're eBay sellers. So it's people who bought them in the 90s who are selling them now.
Okay.
He wrote a book on how to use strong put and, like, live your best life.
Amazing.
And there is a JonBenet tie-in here. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention
it. Oh, my gosh.
Because there is a documentary, I think it's on Netflix, it might be Hulu, about Scott Carruthers. And there's so much of this documentary that, like, really leans into this, like, JonBenet conspiracy theory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it has a lot to do with anything, but basically there was a point in time where they were traveling a lot and they were staying in Colorado. And there is some evidence that points to a couple people in the group that would have been in Boulder the night that JonBenet died.
Oh.
And some people think the note that was left, the ransom note, would have sounded like it could have come from BDX.
Oh, for the love of Peter.
Yeah. So,
far-fetched, but aren't they all?
Far-fetched at best. And I was really surprised at how much this documentary, like, leans into that when there's so much more information about, like, cats talking to the spaceship. And he married 17 women. Like,
cover the parts the people want to know.
Right. I was like, we have enough JonBenet conspiracy theories. We don't need more.
No.
So that is the BDX cult. And I got a lot of my information from the Cult Institute website.
Wow.
Yay.
Good job.
Thanks.
That's wild.
It was a wild one.
That is crazy. Thanks for that. I love a good alien cult. I feel like people rarely die.
Yeah. Well, Heaven's Gate, I think, is probably the biggest.
Oh, yeah.
Alien people dead.
That's
cult.
That's true. We've covered a couple on here.
Yeah.
Raelians. They didn't ever really do anything bad, though.
Yeah. No, Aetherians.
The Aetherians. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll cover Heaven's Gate at some point. It's just such a big one. And there's so many podcasts on the Heaven's Gate that I feel like if you want that information, you can find it.
Surprisingly, now that we've been doing this for a little bit, I find that the big juicy stories that we tell, the ones that are, like, super publicized, are harder to research.
Yeah.
And tell about, because there's so many sources.
There's so many sources.
Conflicting information. It's hard to compile it in a way.
Yeah. And I like covering the ones that, like, maybe people don't know about quite as much. Like, it gives them something new.
Yeah. You know? Like, how many do you need another JonBenet Ramsey episode released on in December? Is that really what you need?
No. I will say this. If I ever cover JonBenet, it will not be in December. Because, like, last December, it was our first December doing podcasting.
Yeah, we did Grimace.
We did Grimace. And I was shocked at how many people told the family, the Larson family, and how many people told JonBenet and then Krampus. It was like every podcast that I'm subscribed to was one of those three stories.
Yeah.
And I was like, we fell into the trap.
I really thought the Lawson family murders was going to be safe because it was so long ago.
Right.
But it was incredibly heinous. So I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I mean, I loved those stories and I loved doing Grimace, but if we do Grimace again, it'll be
we're going to have to get a little deeper.
Get a little deeper.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's your bright and shiny?
My bright and shiny is that today is Lunessa. I'm having a llamas party.
Yeah.
This afternoon. And I have Patrick, my friend Patrick from out of town, and my friend William from out of town, and they're hanging out at my house. It's just, you know, I'm living like a very fruitful and blessed life right now. And that is my bright and shiny.
Exciting.
What's yours?
Let's see. My bright and shiny is that I'm going to your party later.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. You are. I have your salad bowl.
Yeah.
I put your sunglasses inside the salad bowl.
Excellent. So. Yeah. So we're going to have a little hang.
Have a little hangster. Yeah. We're going to, it's going to be good. Celebrate it's the gonna, grains.
Yeah. So, happy Lunessa.
Happy Lunessa. Happy cult day. Don't join a cult. Stay out of the shadows.
Yeah. If you see any red flags, go ahead and turn the other direction.
Run?
Yep.
If we see an orange flag, I would venture to say orange flags.
Yeah.
Yellow flags as well.
Follow your gut.
Listen to your gut. Allow your gut to
guide you.
To guide you.
Out of that situation.
It's not going to lead you astray.
No.
We just had a at length discussion.
Yeah.
About this when we had a movie night a couple days ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Follow your
yesterday.
Gut. Yesterday.
Was that yesterday?
No.
No.
Friday.
Yeah,
follow your gut. It's never going to lead you astray.
It's
if you think
you
something's
alive,
wrong.
Something is wrong.
Something is wrong. If you have ever followed your gut instinct and it got you out of a heinous situation, tell us about it.
Ooh.
You can write it in. What?
I got full body goosebumps. I want to hear everybody's gut instinct that turned out to be true.
Absolutely. I have one.
You do?
Yeah. I'll tell it.
Okay.
I'll tell it on the grab bag.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. I love that. Yeah. Well, listen to your gut and be kind to yourself.
And to others.
Goodbye.